evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape 398. It's July 20th, and side one of the tape. Before I get too long in the tape, I want to make one quick correction on last week's tape. That was number 397, July 13th, 1979. Lee Harvey Oswald came home from the Japanese and Philippine bases, the U-2 bases, in his Marine service on December the 22nd, 1958. And he stayed at El Toro Base, the Marine base in California, until he was discharged September the 11th, 1959. Now, in the tape last week, I mentioned that in March of 59, 4 months after he came home, the school at Madison, Wisconsin, the U.S. Military Academy, had listed that his last location, his last education, was at this particular academy or affiliation with it, and that was 4 months after he returned from the Pacific, from the tour of duty. I had the El Toro as his postal station while he was away, and also it continued until he was discharged. But so far as we know, as of yet, he wasn't flown home from Japan to Madison, Wisconsin. But he was explained by the Warren Report as having taken one or two weekends off to go down to Tijuana while he was stationed at El Toro, and they're very precise about who he saw or what he did, precise in an obscure way, the way the Warren Commission worked. But he had his Russian language and his records and his learning kits while he was in Japan and the Philippines. So I don't know if he was flown home and back here to Monterey at the language school, the Presidio School, or whether he went right into Madison, Wisconsin, or how he last attended that school. But on the books, he was in California. He wasn't at Japan, in Japan at the time that he was supposed to be at this academy. This was a very heavy week in terms of news, but I think it is every single week there is so much coming out that's of importance. This was the anniversary of the moon landing, and Bill Kasing was on KGO for an hour again talking about his book and the moon hoax. For those of you that don't have my tape or don't have the book, I'm going to give you the address one more time because it would be interesting to correspond with Mr. Kasing. He lives not too far from me. Just about 45 minutes away up in Soquel, near Santa Cruz. And you can write to him for information on why he thinks we never landed at the moon. Also, the House Select Committee on Assassinations came out with their report this week. David Bellin was on KGO for 1 hour, giving his multiple lies in defense of the Warren Commission. He's been defending them for 15 years. He was an attorney on the staff. And I will take one entire tape maybe and just refute what David Bellin was spouting out this week on radio stations out here, and also analyze his article in the New York Times defending the Warren Commission again. But as the report came out, the FBI was urged by the chairman of the committee, Mr. Stokes, Louis Stokes, for the FBI to continue investigating the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I'm sure that Mr. Stokes knows a lot that is top secret. He doesn't want to divulge it. He's asking the Justice Department, the FBI, to do it. Of course, they're not interested, and it is still mandatory to find out not so much who killed John Kennedy, but how the layers of cover-up at this point are still going on and the murders are still going on. I'll be doing more of that later. I also want to comment about General Anastasio Somoza leaving Nicaragua, the West Point graduate. He was put into power by the CIA. He abdicated and ran to Florida to be with his anti-Castro Cuban community. There's comfort in these exiles clustering together, and goodness knows what they're planning in the future. And then, of course, Admiral James Carter was given a hard time in his cabinet, all of them except the ones that should put in their resignations. Mr. Brzezinski's still in, and Cyrus Vance, and Mr. Turner of the CIA, but the cabinet has been asked to resign. You all know those stories. They weren't asked. They submitted their resignations. It was a shaky week. If you can't see the connections between the killing of John Kennedy and that phony government that went on in Nicaragua, or the manipulations of Jimmy Carter's fate, maybe you haven't listened to my tapes long enough, or the advantage of the tapes is that you can play them over and listen. One of the men, John Kennedy, was killed by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon. The other, Somoza, was put in power by the Defense Department and the CIA. finally kicked out by the people. And the last, Jimmy Carter, put in by the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral, the CIA, and his Defense Department cohorts from Annapolis, is now being pulled away, and they're doing a job on him like they did on Salvador Allende. It seems that Jimmy Carter was a weak man put in for an interim till the Pentagon could grow a few more muscles, and now all the rugs are being pulled out of Jimmy Carter at one time. Barrage of criticism, suggestions, he resign, and they're really pretty heavy on Jimmy Carter. Everyone they visit seems to have something tainted about them. There was an article just in the paper yesterday about the last home they visited to meet the ground grass roots. And this was in Carnegie, Pennsylvania. That host, Mr. Bill Fisher, had been charged for arson and criminal mischief. An alcoholic who was at the time intoxicated, but who's undergoing treatment now. And of course, they went on to say the Secret Service generally checks out every single person, that they screen them in one form or another. So the Carters spent an evening with the Fishers. They were the invited guests to get a tune of what's going on in the country. And they were with an alcoholic who's under treatment, who's been charged for criminal offenses before. Now, isn't it strange that Rosalynn Carter is photographed with that multi-murderer from Chicago, and with this crazy maniac, Jim Jones, and now spending an evening asking about the problems of the country for a man who had been charged with arson and for various other problems of freaking out. And the president goes to him to find out the nature of his opinion of what's going on in the country. Not the man doesn't have a valid opinion, but this is generally one more incident of just bringing the Carters down and trying to embarrass them. I saw a marvelous opera this week. It's actually light opera, but it's total opera, all voice. An amazing play, pertinent to today's problems, and very few musical shows are. I think Pacific Overtures by Stephen Sondheim was the last heavy political show of this type I've seen. It's called Evita Peron, and in case it comes to your cities, be sure and see it. And if you don't get a chance to see it, buy the album, it's out, and buy the libretto if you can. You can order them from Drama Bookstore in New York, I'm sure. Evita Peron is based on the life of Eve Peron, the second wife of Juan Peron, the Argentine president. It's the story of a poor woman born 1919, the year that World War I was over, when Germany had decided it will illegally rearm, and at the time that Woodrow Wilson was being poisoned with a lingering death instead of a quick death when he went to France to sign the Versailles Treaty. The parallels here seem to be overwhelming, and that's why I want to bring this up to you, for the many layers of what's going on now and the pure genius of this production. Of course, Argentina was the location of Germans from the end of World War I up through World War II and afterwards for Nazis and their headquarters of espionage close to Antarctica and through Brazil and Uruguay, Paraguay, and Chile. This Eva was a poor woman, illegitimate, no background to speak of. She falls in love with a singer at a cabaret, and he takes her to Buenos Aires. And then through a series of vignettes, they show how she has a series of men that she sleeps with, going from the musician up to the generals, the colonels and the generals, a series of love affairs, and then she meets Peron, and she convinces him to run for president of Argentina. He's one of a group of military men who want the post. They have a scene there of a large rocking chair, symbolic maybe of John Kennedy's rocking chair or the game of politics, where there's six huge rocking chairs on the stage with the military men sitting in them. And they remind me of the teams we have now running for president of the United States, identical to Argentina at the time Peron got in. We have John Connolly, who was Secretary of the Navy and Treasury, close ties with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Industry Security Command, Howard Baker of the CIA, who hushed up the Nixon-Watergate connections, and the CIA connections, according to the William Colby report, he had close control of Howard Baker, Gerry Ford, the best congressman the CIA ever had, then being put in as president to continue covering up the tracks, and of course, Alex Haig. You see, you could take each of these men today and put them in those rocking chairs and say which one, by musical chairs that they play on the stage, one remains, and we have Haig of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, George Bush, former director of the CIA, and Jimmy Carter, the graduate of Annapolis and Navy Intelligence. And, of course, Ted Kennedy with his strong links to the Aristotle Onassis Combine and a counterintelligence, a so-called left group that have been very far right with things like the Senate crime bill and the Justice Department and suppressing the murders of his brother, concealing the crimes of the intelligence community. So our candidates today are similar to those men that were sitting in the rocking chairs. And she convinces him to run for president, and he wins. And the people love Evita because she comes from them. She was poor like them. And on the stage, they had two chorus lines, a group of 10, about 10 or 12 people in each group. And one represented the ruling class, the aristocracy, the ones linked to the nobility in Europe. They go to London for their clothes at Harrods. And they're the rich people of Argentine. And they symbolically can be the rich ruling monarchy of any country. And then the military that dance like toy soldiers, and they sing and dance. And the ruling class and the military hate Eva Perón because she got her appeal by saying, I'm one of you, I'm one of the masses, working her way up through the people. But having come from the working class, she betrays them. She isn't satisfied with the adoration of the poor. What she really longs for is the acceptance of the rich. And she has schemes to take the money from the poor and throw a few crumbs at them while she goes after the approval from the crowned heads of states that she wanted as the wife of Perón, and she can't get because she was of a very low origin socially and because of her previous background. There's a scene where she goes to get clothes at Christian Dior, and she has diamonds, and she displays herself and dresses like the rich and thinks that then she'll be accepted by the rich. And she goes abroad for international approval, and the play has a screen that comes down, and you have news clips going on all the time of the actual Evita Perón. And she goes to Europe. She goes to Franco, to Spain, a fascist dictatorship. She goes to visit the Pope, who had such close links with the Nazis, and Mussolini, making deals to be quiet about their fascism in exchange for property that the Vatican would get. So she keeps saying to the people at home, I come from you, but she really goes to heads of states of the fascist regime. She goes to Paris, where she's entertained. The British monarchy refuses to accept her, and she comes home hurt. She is not accepted by them. But her husband, Juan Perón, sends her alone on what is called a rainbow tour. He knows that the military doesn't want her and the rich don't want her, and there's a scene of him while she's parading around Europe with two young girls sitting on his lap. He adored children, prostitutes, little girls. In fact, the woman that Evita kicks out when she moves into Juan's bed is lying in bed with her doll, and she packs up the suitcase and sends her away and begins her career with Juan Perón. And he physically disassociates himself with her exactly like John Mitchell. The man who plays Juan Perón reminds me of John Mitchell, the way he separated from Martha Mitchell at the height of Watergate when she broke the story right from the beginning about the dirty tricks. Juan Perón disassociates himself from Evita because not only do the masses like her more than him, but he knows that his political career was buttered on the rich and on the military. And she comes home and she's sick. And there's a scene of separate bedrooms now. He already has made his distance from her, and she comes in and says that she wants to be his vice president, and he opens the door to her room, and he says, you are dying. And they give her one last radio program to step down from politics, and she dies at the age of 33. And it becomes obvious when you see this play, or it was obvious to me, that the poor in Argentine were never going to get a shake or break any more than they will in the United States through labor or opportunities in many of the industries that they're still excluded from. And while they believed in her and wanted to believe in her, she had no more interest in them because her lifelong dream had been these other people. She got attention just to be used by Juan Perón, by the masses. And when the rich and the military realized that the masses just might catch on and have a people's movement like in the Soviet Union, they had to have her killed. she went to Europe, and as I saw this play, it came to mind, the tape that I did going back April 18th, 1977, that was tape 265, on the poisoning of Woodrow Wilson and minutes of meeting, should we give him the quick death or a slow lingering death. In the play, beginning and ending and throughout the whole play, is a young man called Che. He's the dead ringer for Che Guevara. Che Guevara was born in Argentina. He was a young student there. On the day that Eva Perón died, he was actually 24 years old. Che Guevara went on to study in the Soviet Union and to work with Fidel Castro in Cuba, and then he also was killed in the CIA by the CIA in Bolivia. He represented the people, the poor, the revolution. He makes fun of the mockery of the grand funeral and so forth. Eva Perón was embalmed. The people wanted to preserve her like Lenin. The body was hidden for 18 years, and of course the story of her burial and disappearance and the reappearance of the corpse is another story as intriguing as the life of Eva Perón. She was the mirror of the truth and the reminder of the hypocrisies of people. And I liked the play for many, many reasons, and one of them was that the tragedy of Eva Perón, was similar to what I see in many people's lives and in the social structure around me. People that are poor or from the working class who are socially idealistic in college or right out of college lose that idealism when they work their way up the ladder. There's a song in there. She sings that she's on ring number 9. She says, but I haven't forgotten you at 6 and 7. People work their way up, negate their past, play it safe. And many people, social activists today, have little separate causes that they feel very gratified in doing. They, a large group I saw at Davis, feel that they're very involved if they recycle all their cans and food and glass and separate it and jog, that's their social commitment. Other people feel very safe with joining Save the Whales or not clubbing seals in Canada or at the time of Vietnam, stopping just the napalm in Vietnam. And some people are out at fighting radiation at Three Mile Island or the Shell Clam Alliance, but or down here in Paso Robles, the PG&E plant. But that's the end of their involvement. They take one little thing. They can't handle the big problem. They're afraid of losing status, of losing friends, if they go too far. So most people just keep their mouths shut and watch the game unfold. There's a marvelous song in there called Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. That song isn't allowed in Argentina today. This play opened 2 years ago in London. This is a West Coast troupe that just was in L.A. and San Francisco, then it's going to Broadway. This song, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, is not allowed in Argentina. And if anyone is heard playing it, they're taken to prison, and that's the end of them. Even by cassette or records today, this song is not allowed in Argentina. In her last hours, she flashes back on the images of her life and what went through her mind, and ask the question, would she be happier as an obscure person? I don't think the question is, should I remain poor and happy and live a long time, or whether I should do something worth dying for that I believe in. The point was that she didn't believe in anything except keep climbing that ladder once she got a taste of going up. And the higher she went up, as Che kept saying, the harder it was to fall. And he would talk to her as she undressed, looking in the mirror, and point out the problem that she presented in wanting to please the poor but wanting the approval of the rich. The comparison between Evita Perón and Jimmy and Rosalind Carter came to my mind, because Carter was handpicked by the trilateral, as I say, the Bilderbergers, David Rockefeller, and that gang. And the image was he came up from the people, and they got this folksy sort of a combination of a Minnie Will Rogers, the governor from Georgia, who wasn't too good at that, the peanut farmer, the quaint mother from the Peace Corps, the sister, the faith healer, a little bit for everything, the rock musicians, the Greg Allman band that he was with or helped him with his first campaign money. And you had the priest type going, the Sunday school teacher from the segregated church. And then he goes into the White House. They go fishing before they go into the White House. Barbara Jordan, the black woman, gives this great speech at the Democratic convention, and people for a moment thought there was hope, and he was just the pawn of the military, and now they're tearing him apart. They used him like they used Martha Mitchell or Evita Perón to get the masses roused up and get a single cohesive group that they can manipulate en masse. But now Jimmy Carter has to vote every weapon system. He has to have a closed system of the CIA. His cabinet is falling apart. He's getting the Salvador Allende treatment with bus strikes, radio commentaries day and night out here. I don't know what you're getting in New York, attacking him. When his same staff worked for Ford or Haig or Nixon, we never heard about them, like Califano or Cyrus Vance and Brzezinski. But when they worked for Jimmy Carter, he's criticized for a lot of the decisions. Schlesinger could work for these other people, and when he brings on this energy crisis, Jimmy Carter is to blame. They're ripping him apart piece by piece until the country can be stopped with all kinds of disturbances and even suggestions on the radio that he resign. He's neither fish nor fowl. He doesn't represent the people he said he would represent when he came in, and he doesn't really represent the ruling class. He falls apart having to go through those orders. He wants the acceptance of the David Rockefellers and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and yet he wants the people to love him. And I think the tragedy of Jimmy Carter is like the tragedy of Evita Perón, traveling country to country to get approval in Japan, Austria, all over the world, making conferences, trying to meet and having people, and all of them laughing at him while his right-hand man, Bert Lance, is indicted for criminal charges. And as I say, his wife visits these notorious criminals that are controlled by the intelligence community. Carter is falling apart. Of course, the tragedy of his falling apart is our tragedy. And that's what Che is saying in the play Evita. He's saying it was Argentine's tragedy. When she dies, we die. You know, the hopes die off. And what comes down, her deceit to the laborers, to the poor, his deceit to us is our whole tragedy. And as they manipulate him, Jimmy Carter, and they manipulated the regime in Argentina, they were simply causing the kind of chaos that preceded Adolf Hitler as an excuse to bring in Haig or Connally or Bush or any of the military dictatorships under Kissinger again and Brzezinski on the get us on the verge of World War III. These tragic people are selected and handpicked as leaders and let everybody down and fool themselves and end up very pathetic comedy, tragedy creatures. If you can, as I say, get the record and get the libretto. It's a marvelous play, and the parallels of the poisoning of Wilson, and I believe the poisoning of Evita, getting her out of the way, and the distance that the mates played while the other mate died. There's a lot in there that I see in a lot of other things I've studied. Last week, I did a section of the tape on a man named Robert Opel, who was murdered in San Francisco. And even though we have these earth-shaking events taking place right in front of us, I want to go back to Robert Opel case because it's a microcosm of what's going on in the world, and it's terribly important to read and follow the murder of this particular man. He was murdered last July 19, 1979. Two people came into his home. They tied up two other people that were there in a back room, and they shot his head, blew his head off, and left. He's one of these little heroes that we should take a moment, as I say, to pay our respects to and to analyze because of the bigger story behind what the Robert Opel story. I said that I was outraged because the San Francisco Chronicle described the murder is being motivated, the headlines, as a $5 murder. And the San Jose Mercury said the Wards, that means the Academy Awards streaker, killed in a holdup. And they described it as a holdup. This is the gentleman who in 1974 ran across the stage nude at the Academy Awards. But Opel was a political man, and he had recently hung in effigy a Dan White in front of the UN Plaza in San Francisco. He pretended to shoot a friend dressed in all white, and there was a mock execution of Dan White. But I want to do a little follow-up on the Opel case because of the alleged robbery. And this is the story. Robert Opel, according to San Francisco Examiner, another story about him, was an absolutely free man. This is the lead story of Robert Opel yearning to be a free man. When arrested at the L.A. City Council meeting for appearing nude, he appeared at the trial dressed as Uncle Sam. He carried out this mock execution of Dan White, and he handed out leaflets in San Francisco at the time of the sentencing of Dan White. One admirer said there was a reason behind all of his antics. He was described in some ways as a visionary, and one of the things that he thought was important was sexual repression be stopped, because it was politically expeditious to pick on people because of their sexual habits and come down on them identically to the way that Adolf Hitler did with homosexuals. He sent them to the concentration camps for extermination, all except his top SS guards and army himself. But the street homosexuals were slain along with Jews and other political activists. Opel was described by an editor in the Bay Area as seeing a lot of political in mundane things. That's one of my problems, I think, is seeing political in mundane things, and also it's a saving grace to be able to see them. He ran art galleries in the gay community and wanted to start art galleries around the country run by gays. There was a quotation, he didn't do anything that did not have some kind of political or social statement. He was conscientious. He went about doing things differently. And because he was conscientious, as I say, I want to follow up the Opel killers. Now, three people were caught, two men and a woman, Maurice Keenan, Robert Kelly, and Linda Holt. Only two men entered the room when he was killed. They were found at the San Francisco airport. They had baggage and many belongings. They were on their way to Florida. They were going to take a 10-day vacation. These were three people who allegedly blew this man's head off for $5. And according to the San Francisco Examiner, they had suitcases of all kinds of things. They carried walkie-talkies. They could be in communication with each other when they were apart. And they went in to buy, Ms. Holt, the woman, went in to buy three plane tickets for Florida. Now, a 10-day vacation, suitcases with, in quotes, all kinds of things, and no narcotics. Another motive was supposed to be narcotics deal. There were no narcotics among their possessions and none in Opal's apartment. Mr. Keenan was angry when he was arrested. He went off to the jail with the other two, and he made the remark to the inspector, "What are all these freaks with the cameras?" Now, the next day, there was supposed to be an arraignment, and the man who allegedly shot off Opel's head, Robert Opel's head, was not put with the other two people who were arrested, Robert Kelly and Linda Holt. He was put in a separate cell with people who were in there overnight for being drunk. And they took his handcuffs off. They put him in the cell. The cell door was open. He walked right out of court. When you're arrested, they take your money and your keys and put them in a paper bag, your belongings. He had his evidently money with him. The two men who were watching him or guarding him, deputies, William Sinclair and Anthony Kovich, have been suspended, temporarily at least, probably promoted on the sly, been suspended. He never showed up for his arraignment. He went to his father's home in San Bruno, which is about 30 miles south of San Francisco. And when the police notified that this man had disappeared, the police were ordered to stake that house. And how they knew so fast where his father lived, I don't know, but they knew the house where his father lived in San Bruno. I said this man could be working as a plainclothes agent for Dan White and the police department, and they were getting even with him for mocking the Dan White sentence in San Francisco. He went to the home where he picked up clothes, and they said on the media he could have shaved off his long hair and his mustache. He picked up more money and weapons, and he's been gone ever since. The newspaper said he may have several dollars in his pocket. They didn't bother to say how he got transportation to San Bruno, how they knew where the father's house was, why it wasn't staked. So the first error was, after the alleged killer was caught, was to put him in a cell separate from the others, remove the handcuffs, let him walk out of the court, the cell door was opened, go to his father's home in San Bruno, and he hasn't been seen since. And that is the story of the man who blew off the head of Robert Opel, a very political person in San Francisco. And to follow that story on the other side of this tapes, we're going to do a little bit about more about the politics of San Francisco, because, as I say, what happens in California, you can see coming down across the country. This is the nest of counterintelligence, and it is very active and busy. And this man was allowed to go free, not only out of the San Francisco jail, but in San Bruno, and they were allowed to get to the airport, and he has escaped, and he's out loose, and for all we know, could be in any part of the world or flown out Mexico, South America, given a new identity. The man wiped out any dissent on the streets, the man who made the handbills. And that's important, because how many people are going to duplicate that street scene? And they'll get the message that their heads be blown off, and they'll be afraid to do what Opal did.